This is an MP3 audio clip from the weekly People First radio broadcast.
CHLY 101.7 Nanaimo.
Canada's prison ombudsman, Howard Sapers, whose official title is the Correctional Investigator, has investigated and chronicled the serious failures within Canada's correctional service system that led to the tragic death of 19-year-old inmate Ashley Smith on October 19, 2007. Ashley Smith died by suicide after choking herself in a prison cell at Grand Valley Institution for Women in Kitchener, Ontario. Kim Pate is Executive Director of Elizabeth Fry Societies of Canada, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you.
You were able to visit Ashley Smith while she was in segregation at the Grand Valley Institution. What did you discover during your visit?
Well, I visited her. I tried to visit her first when she was in a psychiatric center run by corrections. I wasn't permitted to. And then I first visited her in her first visit to Grand Valley Institution because, as you know, she was transferred some 17 times throughout a number of the institutions. And on the first visit, we were very concerned about a number of things, why she was being transferred so much, what the classification, why they had classified her as maximum security, and why they were keeping her in segregation. She also indicated that she had been assaulted by staff, so we wanted to investigate those allegations and also wanted to look at what the assessment was in terms of her mental health issues. She indicated that she'd been told she had a number of diagnoses and she wasn't sure what they were. And so that's what we were attempting to investigate. So with her consent, we went about trying to get the documentation for that. And then the next time I see her, I go to each of the federal prisons a couple of times a year with our regional advocates, who are the people who go in monthly and do the monthly visits. And so the second visit, sadly, was 3 weeks before her death. We didn't know that at the time. But at that time, she was still in segregation, or again in segregation, and this time with nothing in her cell. The time previous, we had at least been able to speak with her through the meal slot, and I was able to, she was able to sign the document, write the documents and sign the documents. This time, she wasn't permitted any human contact, was naked except for a security gown, and had nothing, not even a mattress, not a blanket, nothing in her cell. And so I was quite desperate, and she asked us to look into that as well.
It's hard to believe we're talking about places in Canada when you hear this story.
Yes.
I mean, it is just so appallingly shocking.
Well, and we have some of the, legally, we have some of the best protections in the world. And, you know, amazingly, we do have one of the best correction systems in the world. And so when one knows that and knows that that's what happens when in the best in the world, one can only imagine what happens in some of the places where Canada is going, you know, Canada is, for instance, going overseas and taking its knowledge and assisting people to set up other prison systems without first really ensuring that its own house is in order and that we have the appropriate accountability mechanisms to ensure that the law isn't breached here.
What are the experiences of women in prison who have mental illnesses?
Well, most of the people who have mental health issues when they come into a prison setting, if they're minor, and by that I don't mean that they're experienced as insignificant by the people who have them. Of course they're not.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're individuals who may be very depressed, may have an illness that is easier to manage in a prison, something that doesn't involve potentially a lot of self-harm or acting out that impinges on other people's space, they may be able to stay in a unit. So the incidence of depression, for instance, not surprisingly for anybody who's in prison, is very high. It's particularly high amongst women. And a lot of women live in the general population, dealing with their depression, dealing with, sometimes anxiety disorders, that sort of thing. Those who have intellectual disabilities tend to be the ones who fill up the mental health units because while they may have mental health issues as well, they often are easier to manage by the staff. And you know, we're talking staff who themselves have, you know, often great intentions. They don't come into these institutions generally expecting to do anything but do the best job they can with individuals. But in a prison context, a person is seen first through the lens of prisoner and criminal conviction and not to, as it would be in a hospital, and I'm not suggesting that all hospitals are good either, but at least in a psychiatric center, a mental health setting, the behavior that people exhibit is generally seen and considered as part of the issues that go along with the mental health label or psychiatric label that may be attached to them. And so their behavior is not necessarily seen as manipulative and intentional, mm-hmm. acting out or negative behavior. And so that's a key difference in prison. And so if one considers that, it's not surprising to see that most people with significant mental health issues end up very quickly in segregation for those two reasons. One, it's an easier place for them to be managed and separated from the rest of the population. They can be locked up, watched while on camera. And secondly, if the behavior is viewed as fundamentally an issue of their being bad, quote-unquote, or purposely trying to engage the staff in negative, with what's seen as otherwise negative behavior, then they can be isolated in that way and watched. And yet we know from, in some ways it's just common sense, people who are having a hard time generally need people around and want people around. And so what happens is the mental health issues that people come in with tend to be exacerbated by that isolation, because the lack of human contact, the lack of humane treatment.
Mm, sort of just results. Common sense.
Mm. That's right. That's
You're
right.
Listening to People First Radio. I'm Kevin. I'm here with Jan. We're speaking with Kim Pate, Executive Director of the Associations of Elizabeth Fry Societies of Canada, about the experiences of women in prison who have mental illness.
How did Ashley end up in prison? I understand she'd been experiencing, obviously, some mental health issues throughout most of her young life.
Well, what's interesting is I didn't know this until after her death. Again, tragically, so many things that we were trying to have addressed, people, wouldn't engage until after Ashley died. And that's always one of the things that haunts those of us who do this work, and haunts many Canadians, because I've heard from many people who are parents who worry that the same fate could befall their children. She was a young person who, as many young people do, as they're exploring their identity and who they are and starting to experience the hormones of adolescence, started, what would be seen as not necessarily unusual acting out, but acting out that because of where she did it and how she did it came to the attention of authorities. And we know that's particularly true of people with mental health issues who may have come to the attention of authorities. That wasn't necessarily what had happened in Ashley's case. She hadn't been identified at that stage, as far as we know, as having a mental health issue. She was someone who was seen as a young person who acted out somewhat. And she was on probation for throwing crab apples at a postal worker when she was breached for that, because she had allegedly shoplifted and had breached her curfew, or I think it was her curfew or the area that she was supposed to be in, or perhaps both. And she was therefore taken into custody on that breach. And before she ended up in court to have that breach dealt with, or even to have the appearance of whether she should be detained in custody, she had already responded negatively to being arrested. I'm not sure all of what happened, because I wasn't there and we don't have access to the records yet, even as I speak, 2 years after her death. What often happens to many young women is many of them have experiences of sexual abuse, physical abuse. And when they're taken into custody, one of the first things that often happens is that they're strip searched. And we have a number of young women who, by the time they get to court, have accumulated charges such as resisting arrest, obstructing a police officer, sometimes assault a police officer, other charges that relate to them either trying to stop the process of being strip searched or trying to stop,
mm-hmm.
sometimes just run off or run away or try to get away. And so sometimes it's an attempted escape or escape, that sort of thing. And she had accumulated a number of charges, including pulling a fire alarm and that sort of thing, by the time she mm-hmm. got to court. And that just continued to snowball, that in the system she continued to accumulate charges. And as many staff have said since she died, and at the time that I was trying to assist and determine what we could be doing to assist her then, many staff indicated that if you treated her with respect and humanity and didn't treat her as though you were better than her, and which is, a key issue for her in terms of her sense of fairness, then she would respond likewise. And certainly she had visits with her family that where there was, you know, no issue around her behavior. And yet the vilification, even after her death, continues, that she's described as someone who was constantly in a state of fighting with the staff, hurting herself. Mm-hmm. And while it's true there were many, many incidents and she accumulated many, many charges, I believe it's either 87 or 97 new charges and convictions while she was in custody for those 5 years, the reality is that she, most of those were very, were not considered serious, and they're very short sentences. So it was the accumulation of those that led to her, actually, by the time she died, mm-hmm. she was serving 6.5 years.
Okay.
And what started as a breach of probation.
Kim, I just have a, I'm very curious as to know how it could be that the 7 guards were ordered to not intervene.
Like, yeah, I mean, that is a question.
Do you understand that?
Well, I don't understand how that can happen. I mean, I understand on the one level that people are given orders, but I do know that there were staff who indicated to us that they would rather, and some apparently did face some disciplinary charges for intervening nevertheless, because, as you know, one particular staff said to me, I would rather be disciplined for saving someone's life than disciplined after the fact for or living with myself after the fact if someone died. And this was someone who had intervened and was apparently, I'm told, disciplined after she intervened and at a time that staff had been told not to intervene. And so on a practical level, the view was that if in fact she was still struggling and therefore might struggle with staff who were trying to remove a ligature or trying to stop her from harming herself, then she should be left until she was unconscious. Now, what we know is that research in Canada here has shown that when someone can tie a ligature around their neck, they can be dead very, very quickly. And it's not, there is no clear way to determine when, it's not whether they're blue, it's not whether they're motionless, whether they're dead or not. And so the fact that that would even be issued as an order is, you know, is somewhat incomprehensible. And
we have just a moment left, Kim. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add to our conversation today as we wrap this up. Unfortunately, we've run out of time.
Right. Well, I think for all of your listeners to think about the implications of this and what, not just what happened to Ashley, what happens to far too many people inside, if it was their mother, their daughter, their child who was at risk. And I think too often the glib answers that are being provided now with longer sentences, more harsh sentences, making people earn their way out as if they don't already have to do that, if the answer seems too easy, it probably is. And the reality is there are some easier ways to do things, and that is to insist that all men, women, and children in this country have freedom from want, have what we know a rich country like ours can provide, which is food, clothing, accommodation, and education and health services for all individuals, so that they don't end up marginalized and victimized and in a situation where they might end up criminalized too. And I think to have all of your listeners take action, even if it's just to notify their member of parliament that they don't support measures that will lead to more people being in custody without the kind of accountability that needs to ensure that they're actually getting any kind of support, and instead to have those support services in the community.
Kim Pate, we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Kim Pate is Executive Director of the Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies of Canada. The voluntary nonprofit organization represents 26 member societies across Canada. One of the organization's goals is to reduce the numbers of women who are criminalized and imprisoned in Canada.
People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Centre Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society's CHLY 101.7 FM. CHLY.ca, community radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of these organizations.